everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And happy Valentine's Day to all of you out there. You know, hopefully you're having a very special day by yourself or with your significant other.
Yeah. Cozied up with a significant other, or cozied up with your dog, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Dogs are okay. You know, so we're recording this on Monday and this is going up on Valentine's Day. So all of us will be out with our significant others having a very nice evening.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Sometimes they go south, though.
Yeah.
That's the last thing. Like, you didn't give me anything.
Yeah. True. I guess Kelly won't be watching this until it airs, so I'm good here. But making some carbonara, I was telling you.
Nice.
Also, I got her a Tamagotchi. We got a Tamagotchi connection, like one you can sync up and like play games and shit.
That's sick.
Old school Tamagotchi, just trying to get a nostalgia gift. So
that's a great gift, actually. Yeah. I like that. Danny, you got any good plans?
Man, right now, not too much. I got some medical stuff going on, so we're going to see how Friday is, but I have a nice dinner planned.
Excellent. So well, you delicious. Are a chef, so
yeah,
you can always cook up something special.
I always have that.
You always got that covered.
Yeah. Daniel's actually the one who gave me the tips on the carbonara, so much appreciated.
Pasta and fish. Good at those.
But yeah, today we're covering a pretty brutal case, actually, that's also unsolved. So very important to keep this case in the public, because it's one that should have been solved many, many years ago.
Yeah.
A lot of things fell through the cracks. Law enforcement, you know, gave a subpar job on this one. And at the end of the day, two high school sweethearts were murdered very brutally and tortured at the hand of this killer who is unknown. There are some suspects that are kind of outside the normal scope, I think, kind of out of the box.
Yeah. But there's also some theories that it might be multiple killers, although law enforcement officials didn't really buy that through the profile, but there are some theories there could have been multiple killers.
Yeah, which, I don't know. When we get into it, you might be thinking the same thing, like, how did one person do all the things that they did? So we're going to be covering the case of Patricia Mann and Jesse McBain. As always, we're going to take you back to the very beginning. Our case begins in 1971 in Durham, North Carolina, home to Duke and North Carolina Central University. 20-year-old Patricia Mann, sometimes called Pat by family and friends, was known as a sweet, quiet young woman. She was incredibly close with her family, especially her cousins. She attended church every week and was also a great student and a hard worker. She had casually dated in the past, but 19-year-old Jesse McBain had been her first serious boyfriend. They were high school sweethearts, and, you know, after high school, they went off to college and they continued their relationship. Jesse was tall, handsome, athletic, and he attended North Carolina University at Chapel Hill, about a half hour away from Patricia. In high school, he was voted most likely to succeed. He was described as nice, funny, and handsome, and just had an overall great personality. He wrestled and he played football, and those who knew him only had good things to say about him. Together, Jesse and Patricia were a very strong couple, although they had brief moments of an on-again, off-again relationship. I mean, they're young. It's to be expected.
Yeah.
You know, you're still trying to figure out the ropes of a long-term relationship.
Yeah, especially when the questions of going to different colleges comes up, it gets a little shaky, right?
Totally. In high school, Patricia and her cousin Carolyn were both passionate about nursing. Carolyn lived across the street from Patricia growing up, and the two were inseparable. Her cousin urged her to apply to the Watts College of Nursing in Durham, one of the best nursing schools in the state. Her cousin ended up not getting in, but Patricia was accepted. She doubted whether she wanted to go, considering that her cousin wasn't going to be going, and she'd be far away from Jesse and her family. But they all urged her to go, since it would be a great opportunity. Patricia and Jesse stayed together while she went to Watts and attended UNC. They had gotten used to being separated since they had grown up in different towns and attended different high schools. As Patricia was from Sanford and Jesse was from Pittsburgh, North Carolina, Eventually, Jesse asked permission to marry Patricia, and her family gave him the go-ahead. He even gave her a promise ring to hold her over until he could officially propose. Unfortunately, they couldn't talk on the phone much because they were in separate counties, and, you know, at this time in history, long-distance calls were very expensive. Yeah, I kind of remember the tail end of it.
Yeah, and they had to, I think it was, the prices got way crazier if it crossed county lines or something like that. Yeah, so they were like, we just don't have the money for that.
And the only solution back then was to good old snail mail.
Handwritten, which I think
it's kind of
more romantic, yeah.
Although I don't think my wife want any handwritten notes from me. You can't read it.
Is it illegible?
It's very bad. I have very bad handwriting. Yeah, I'm kind of insecure about it, but I'm great at typing. I'll type you up a letter all day long.
There you go. You could do a typed letter.
I would get a typewriter.
Yeah. That would be really cool, honestly. Yeah.
Those are my mom had one of those. I remember her typing on a typewriter when she was in college when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by it. She'd be like, ka-ching. And then
it was so cool. I would steal my mom kept hers for a really long time. It was an electric typewriter that she had used in school. And I would always bring it up to my room, plug it in, because I thought it was fascinating. And the way that it smelled when it turned on, all the electronics, it just had a weird, distinct smell. Like the feel of it too.
Yeah, those were definitely the days, man. Yeah. You know? It's a little bit more personal to write a letter to.
Yeah, agreed.
You know, a lot more effort goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
But the small annual Valentine's Day dance at Watts Hospital, which is where Patricia worked at the time, took place in the winter of 1971, and she invited Jesse to the dance as her date. Jesse and his brother shared a vehicle together, a Ford Cortina. So at first, Jesse told Patricia that he couldn't go since his brother had plans to use the car that evening. A small argument followed, as you can imagine, but Jesse then talked to his brother and they both figured out a way to switch schedules so Jesse could borrow the car for the dance, because it's a big deal. On February 12th, 1971, Patricia got off class and returned to her dorm, where she was ecstatic to see Jesse, and he was finally there for the dance. Together, they got ready, and Jesse wore some burgundy plaid pants and a colored button-up.
Woo!
Definitely 70s.
Yeah.
And Patricia wore a white and pink checkered dress with green accents with a bow and a belt. Then they met up with some friends before heading off to the dance. Once they got there, the dance ended up being a lot more chill than they had expected. There was only about 50 people in attendance, so they only stayed for a bit before leaving at 11:30 p.m. Patricia told her friends that she would return to her dorm by curfew, which was 1 a.m. Normally, it was strictly 11 p.m., but because of the holiday, it was extended a couple of hours. She told them that she and Jesse were going to go, quote-unquote, parking, meaning that they were going to go find a secluded place in the car to go hook up. You know, that was a thing.
I like that lingo, park. We're going to go parking.
Yeah, it's like a code word.
Yeah.
Now we're just so blunt about it.
I'm going to go fuck my boyfriend. Yeah.
In the back seat. Yeah. Now we got songs that are...
Romance and chivalry is dead.
Have you heard that song, Diet Pepsi?
No.
By Addison Rae? It's a banger for sure.
Just super explicit.
But it's about like getting on in the back seat and she's like sipping on Diet Pepsi. It's just like...
It's not like, Diet Coke?
No, not Diet Coke. Yeah, I know. I was
Come on. It's gross.
Superior soda here.
Yeah.
As they left the dance together, this was the last time that they were ever seen alive. Patricia never returned to her dorm, so the following day, her roommate and a high school friend named Gail, who was also another nursing student, reached out to Patricia's parents, asking if she had by chance gone to their place that night. She hadn't, and Patricia's parents became worried. Patricia's nursing friends then called all the local hospitals asking if Patricia had been admitted to any, but there was no sign of her. Durham police suggested that the couple eloped since they had been engaged, which they weren't technically engaged. Nope. He gave her a promise ring. Right. Difference there. And again, friends, family, like, what are you talking about? They were planning on getting married after college. So why on earth would they just go and elope on Valentine's Day?
Yeah. We've seen this before. It's where it's like they ran away. It's the same type of thing. They eloped. They just ran away.
I just want to ask the officer who like came up with that idea. I'm like,
what evidence do you
what's
have?
What's going through your head that makes you think, well, they said they're going to go parking, so they must have hit the chapel on the way.
And it doesn't make any sense.
They're off to Vegas. Like what? It just doesn't make any sense. Again, no. Different time.
Yeah.
It's hard to wrap your head around it, but that's what they said. I assume as a request, you know, from the family, because the family is very distressed or they want to know where they went. Police then put up some missing persons posters around town, and they also opened up a tip line, and tips came in almost immediately. Within the first day, a woman called in claiming that she saw a young couple carrying a suitcase out near the local Crossdale golf course. The witness then saw this couple walk into the woods. Another tip came in from an employee of a local jewelry store, and they claim they saw the missing couple come in and buy wedding rings. Police later confirmed that the couple at the store was not Jesse and Patricia. A few days went by and there was still no word from the missing couple. The search continued, but no one had seen them. And as more time passed, the police began taking the case much more seriously. So they launched a more thorough search, calling on local volunteers to help. And this time they searched the Watts Hospital, the school dormitories, the local golf course, the woods surrounding the golf course, as well as the nearby neighborhoods and cul-de-sacs, and they even dredged a nearby lake. But again, there was no sign of Patricia or Jesse until February 16th. Friends in a small search party discovered Jesse's Ford Cortina, a family car that was popular in the UK. Jesse and Patricia had used this car the night they had disappeared, and it was abandoned at a local hookup spot on Wayside Place, just off Medford Road. And this was an undeveloped neighborhood where the streets were paved, but not all the houses had been built yet. This had been a common place used as a lover's lane for couples to hook up. According to friends who found the vehicle was empty and the doors were locked, the car had a small triangular vent window on one of the doors that was unlocked, so they pushed it open and unlocked the car.
I don't know if are you familiar with those tiny little windows? They're kind of like just little ventilation windows. They're more on older cars. You don't see them anymore, but it's in the corner of the window. You can kind of, they swivel open.
Was that for like cigarettes?
It's a good,
I
guarantee you that's probably why they had those.
Because I'm like, why else would you have a tiny little window?
Yeah. That's good.
I don't know. It just came to my mind.
They got cigarette lighters and the cigarette ventilation. Yeah.
There you go. I assume that's what it was. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
So inside of the vehicle, nothing was out of place. The only things left behind were Jesse and Patricia's coats and a chocolate bar that Jesse had bought her as a Valentine's Day gift. Once the police arrived and started inspecting the vehicle, they found no signs of a struggle or any blood at the scene. It appeared suspiciously clean. According to some, police asked friends some questions but seemed fairly unconcerned at the time. Many officers still went with the theory that the couple had disappeared and eloped. Meanwhile, friends and family continue to search for Jesse and Patricia because it still doesn't make sense. It's like, no. Why would their car be found abandoned? They're nowhere near it. They haven't talked to anybody or showed up anywhere.
And if they were going to elope, wouldn't they take the car?
Right.
How else are they getting to wherever they're eloping?
What are they going to, they want to go on a hike to where they're going to elope? Like, yeah. Makes no sense.
I don't get it. So on the morning of February 25th, a surveyor, whose name was Robert Kirby, was checking a property out in a remote area near what's now called Duke Forest. And this is about 4 miles from where Jesse's car was parked at the end of a one-lane road. So at the time, this was really just empty private property. All that was nearby were some small, sparse trailer park communities. I think nowadays it's a bit more developed if you go look at it on Google Maps, but as he surveyed the nearby woods, he spotted a grouping of trees, and nearby he saw something poking out of a pile of leaves. As he approached, he saw what looked like a mannequin's leg, but obviously, you know, as he got closer, he soon noticed that it was a human leg, and after looking around a little more, he spotted two bodies loosely covered by leaves. The surveyor quickly ran to the nearest trailer home and asked to use their telephone. He then called the police and told them he believed he had just found the bodies of the missing couple. Police then drove out to the location where a small crowd had already gathered. It's unclear how word spread so quickly, but some suspect the surveyor told residents of the trailer park, who then spread word to even more people. And this was really unfortunate because the crowd could have compromised any potential tire marks or footprints, but it had also rained in the area from the time when the couple went missing to when the bodies were discovered. So who knows, who's to say how much evidence was really even left behind.
Can you blame him for telling people?
Right. It's probably the biggest talk of the town at the time was this missing couple. So no, I couldn't blame him. Or, I mean, someone could have overheard him talking to the police on the phone and right. they spread that. So.
Because, yeah, he had to go use somebody's phone. He could have just like hop on his cell phone and dial 911.
Yeah. So I hope nowadays in the era of true crime, we're at least smarter to just go waltz through towards a crime scene. You know,
right?
I like how maybe we.
You
have
would
a little
think,
bit
but
more
I feel like it
sense.
Still happens. Yeah. You know, there's still plenty of cases where, and usually it's because police didn't secure it as a crime scene,
right.
and they let people back into the property,
right?
Which is unfortunate, but
yeah. So the human remains were found at the base of an oak tree whose trunk had a diameter of about 10 inches, so not that big of a tree. Investigators believe that the original positions of the bodies were in a sitting down position back to back against the trunk, and they were tied around the tree with a type of rope called sisal rope, sometimes called sisal hemp, although it's made from the agave plant. Much of the rope was still intact. So put a pin in this because this rope will come into play much later in the story. So their wrists were also bound with short lengths of rope in a complex knots, and the rope passed 4 times around the left wrist, 3 times around the right wrist, and there were several knots between the 2 hands. Their hands were also connected to another rope that was tied around the base of the tree. There was another length of rope tied around each of their necks using double knots. So quite complex knot setup here that they have to keep them.
Well, it's kind of a, you know, strange place for a killer to put their victims tied to a tree like this.
Yeah. And reportedly the knots around the neck, these were snug, but they were just left a little bit loose. And you'll understand why a bit later. Although initially they might have been back to back in an upright position against the tree, the bodies were found slumped towards the ground in more of a lying position. And it's generally believed that they were possibly pulled further down to this position and then covered with the leaves to hide them. Yeah. So the culprit didn't want these bodies found. Family members later confirmed the identities of both bodies of the deceased to be Jesse's and Patricia's remains. They had been found 13 days after they were last seen. And when they were found at the base of the tree, their clothes and their shoes were still on. Jesse had a pack of cigarettes in his front pocket, along with the keys to his car in his pants pocket. Patricia wore the promise ring that Jesse had gotten her, along with a pearl bracelet and a necklace. Police figured, since they still had these items on them, that theft was not the motive here. Autopsies were performed on the bodies in a Chapel Hill University Hospital the same day they were discovered. The medical examiner concluded that neither had been sexually assaulted, nothing was taken off the bodies, and there were no physical signs of a struggle. They also concluded that they had died shortly after they went missing. So on Patricia's autopsy report, a groove mark bruise from a rope was reported on her neck. They also had hemorrhaging noted on the soft tissue around her hyoid bone, which suggested strangulation. Other signs across the body signified oxygen deprivation. Reportedly, Jesse's autopsy results were nearly identical. It also revealed tight, knotted ropes around his neck and wrists. Both bodies also had 2 to 3 small puncture wounds to the chest, which likely happened after they had died, according to the medical examiner. The only significant difference between the two victims was that Patricia had a 1-inch tear in her liver, which the medical examiner suspected was the result of a blow to the abdomen, possibly by a fist, before death. Since there was speculation that Patricia might have gotten pregnant and the couple was running away, the medical examiner also confirmed that she was not pregnant. Some rumors suspected they were high or drunk, but their toxicology reports came back clean. The probable cause of death for both was strangulation by ligature. Evidence, meaning the ropes. Evidence from the autopsy and evidence from the scene indicated that the ropes tied around their neck were repeatedly tightened and released, causing them to slowly die. So the rope was tightened, then let go to allow the victims to regain their breath and or consciousness, and then they were strangled again. This was evident by the mud on the victim's shoes and the, quote, troughs in the mud where their feet were thrashing in the mud as they were strangled repeatedly. So it was theorized that the offender would go to one side of the tree, pull on the rope until one of the victims lost consciousness, and then move to the other side of the tree to do the same thing to the other victim. So just back and forth. And they estimate that this may have gone on for about 2 hours until both victims eventually died. The medical examiner was of the opinion that there were two offenders pulling on the ropes at the same time. So there's a little bit, we'll get into why there's an argument, two culprits versus one culprit.
Yeah, I was just going to say too, you know, when I'm, as we're describing this, I'm thinking through how this all played out and, you know, that obviously getting some graphic images in my head, but
yeah.
Clearly whoever did this, this screams like personal vendetta against one of them, or both of them. And I think that's evident by the fact that A, they were tortured for at least 2 hours, in a pretty brutal way. I mean,
really
just be
brutal.
Slowly suffocated to
over death. Over
and over. Yeah. And just imagining these ligatures in your neck with these knots that are just digging in and like, I don't know. I can't even imagine. I mean, that just seems incredibly just painful and a horrible way to go. But not only that, the puncture marks, in my mind, I think once they lost unconsciousness and the killer thought that they were dead, they made, you know, double sure that they were dead by doing those puncture wounds, is my guess. Is why they had that. And then the extra tear to Patricia's liver, and based on the medical examiner, that was some type of blunt force to that area of the body, also sort of reinforces my thought that this was some type of jealous, you know, person that wanted to be with her or something like that. And just, it was like very personal, this attack.
Mm.
These murders were, you know, not random in my mind. This seems too premeditated, too planned out for this to be just some type of crime of opportunity. But
yeah, again, I had another thought. I like that. That seems reasonable. I also thought that possibly was Patricia trying to escape, trying to fight back to some degree. And that blow came from like a form of control before they were tied up or something like that. I could also see.
Yeah, definitely.
So if we take it back a little bit to how they even got out there in the first place, it was suspected that someone approached Patricia and Jesse while they were in the car, and it's believed the person must have been some sort of authority figure, possibly a police officer or someone impersonating a police officer, and possibly someone the couple knew. And this is suspected because it appeared that both Jesse and Patricia willingly got out of the vehicle. If you remember, there were no signs of a struggle in or around the car. So then the couple was possibly put into the trunk of the offender's car and then driven out to the woods. Some suspect the offender might have driven Jesse's car and later returned it to the spot. It was also discovered that Jesse's car had been wiped clean, which is why it was so suspiciously clean. There were no fingerprints, not even the victims inside or on the vehicle.
What's interesting about this is I think there's a couple scenarios that could have played out here. I think the possibility of an authority figure, a police officer or somebody imitating a police officer would make sense to some degree. But also, I mean, if these two are parked and hooking up, they're not paying attention to anybody, you know, their surroundings necessarily. And so it's also possible this would probably be easier with two people rather than one, which I think is interesting. But then they could have been, you know,
pulled out guns and said, get out of the car.
Guns, yeah. Or they could have been chloroformed. And that's a possibility. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you could pull somebody out of the car. And, you know, signs of a struggle in a vehicle. I mean, what does that even mean? You know,
and yeah, like were they looking for like some
the dash is smashed or
yeah, something like that?
And you know, cars are fairly durable, right? Like it takes serious, you know, lots of kicking and things like that.
True,
a pretty big struggle to leave significant damage inside the vehicle. And again, it seems very obvious that whoever abducted them went back and cleaned it up and
definitely, you know,
wiped everything down and put back whatever was out of place. But
which, so this is someone conscious of leaving behind evidence.
Yes.
So, which also goes into the theory of like someone possibly in law enforcement. But the various agencies investigating agreed that the offender or offenders planned the attack beforehand and they were familiar with the location. Multiple agencies soon became involved in the case, and this included the Orange County Sheriff's Office, the Durham Sheriff's Office, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, and the North Carolina Department of Motor Vehicles. Police Sergeant Tim Bowers of the Durham Police Department was the first investigator assigned to the case, and he had actually just been promoted to detective that winter. So Sergeant Bowers then reached out to New York criminal psychologist Dr. James Brussel to create a profile of the killer. So Dr. Brussel had aided police in the Boston Strangler and New York's Mad Bomber cases. And according to this psychological profile of the Valentine's Day killer, the killer was between 25 and 40 years old, athletic, and a paranoid person who was, quote, out to cleanse the world. The offender was a loner, neat, precise, and had an above average education. He also might have had a personal grudge against the victims, which Josh was saying. He was probably clean shaven, might have had a criminal record, had an excellent work record, didn't wear flashy clothes, appeared to conduct himself properly, and may have suffered from childhood rejection by his mother. He often considered himself to be above other people and judged them harshly. Dr. Brussel also believed that there was only one offender because the psychological profile determined that this type of criminal wouldn't have taken any unnecessary risks that come with an accomplice. Things like snitching or maybe being sloppy, right? Like if someone's really OCD about the kill and was planning this, you know, you don't want anyone else to screw it up. From then on, police mostly suspected only one offender had committed the crimes, but still some suggest that there was possibly two, including the medical examiner. If you remember from their report, they figured that there were two offenders.
Yeah, and just, yeah, again, unless they were held at gunpoint and walked out there, if they're disabled or disoriented or anything like that, it's going to be much more difficult for one person to get, you know, basically two adults out to the woods,
right,
by themselves. Is it possible? Yes, but to do it all in complete secrecy and to know exactly where to go and not leave this big long trail of, you know,
right,
dragging someone or something like that, or risk something falling off of them. I mean, one seems pretty difficult unless you have total control of the situation, which
right,
still possible. So I don't know. I think the medical examiner's note is something that shouldn't just be
seems disregarded,
like disregarded, yeah, the way that sure, the law, you know, police did. But
yeah, there might have been some rank pulling there, like, oh, this guy's worked on several high profile cases, we got to trust his psychological profile. I'm assuming that that played a part into it. But many leads were investigated over the years, but the case unfortunately went cold for a variety of reasons. Difficulties like separate case files and disagreements between different departments and offices, as well as struggles to narrow in on suspects and a lack of physical evidence, ultimately led the investigation nowhere. No arrests were made. But armchair investigators have proposed that even the Zodiac Killer or the Golden State Killer were involved, but really their MOs and locations did not line up with the Valentine's Day murders.
Yeah, so, and I mean, totally different state.
Yeah.
Killer, different side of the country.
Not even close. I think this tends to happen with unsolved cases after a while. People just make
start throwing out theories. Names. Yeah.
For a while after the murders, locals avoided the woods of Duke Forest, where Patricia and Jesse were found, fearing that a killer had lurked there at night. Years passed with no developments in the case, and then in 2011, investigators Tim Horn and Don Hunter from the Orange County Sheriff's Office found a box of evidence relating to this case. Tim Horn said, quote, rubber bands had broken, paper clips had fallen off, pages were out of order. The file was a mess. It was just all thrown into a box. Once we got this back together, we each made a copy and we would compare notes. So they worked in their free time off duty to piece the case file together, which
good for them.
Yeah, that's noble. This was after almost 40 years too, so keep that in mind. And investigators Horn and Hunter became the first investigators possibly ever to actually see all of the evidence generated by the various law enforcement agencies, because that was kind of the difficulties in the first place. It was just these different, I think, what is it, four agencies were working on this case at once, all building kind of separate case files too.
Yeah, the sharing of info was definitely not as easy as it is today with computers.
And exactly.
It was all paper, you know.
The analog,
And be like driven over there and delivered. And
right.
Hope that somebody actually filed it away or looked at it.
Right. So Detective Horn also happened to be working on the case file when, coincidentally, Patricia's cousin, Carolyn, who, if you remember, that was her cousin who also wanted to be a nurse at the time.
Close friends, yeah.
Yeah. She called and asked for an update on the case. Detective Horn then worked to petition Sheriff Pendergrass to have the case reopened. The sheriff agreed, and in 2012, the case was officially reopened. There were obvious setbacks when returning to a case that was over four decades old, and Detective Horn said, quote, "It's very hard to develop new information. You have to rely on the photographs and the files and the evidence of that time period and how it was collected and preserved and stored," i.e. kind of what we were saying. Pre-computers, it was just a different time. But reopening the case drew attention from all over and opened up new potential leads.
I want to give the investigators even more kudos that it takes tons of time to sift through all those papers and organize that in a way that makes sense, you know, a lot harder than just reviewing documents online or on the computer. So, you know, the fact that they put in all the extra off-duty time to do it, to at least take a look at it after 40 years is commendable.
Yeah. So the reopened case drew attention to an urban legend dating back to 1972, and this was a year after the murders. Oddly, there was no paper trail for this attack. No police reports, no media reports, no longtime residents could lead investigators to the victims. Until a call came in from a retired officer who had worked from the State Bureau of Investigation, and he told Detective Horn about the case from 1972. A couple on a lover's lane, near where Patricia and Jesse had been attacked, were approached by a man armed with a gun. He forced them into the trunk of his car and drove to Orange County. The man was pistol whipped and suffered permanent nerve damage, but luckily both victims had escaped. According to Detective Horn, there was a single sketch of the attacker made, and he claimed it closely resembled one of the suspects from the Valentine's Day murders case. I could not find this sketch anywhere. Detective Horn had also opened up the case file to Eric Pruitt, a writer and filmmaker, and Drew Adamack, a journalist. Together, they had already been looking into the case for about a year and a half. The victims' families and Detective Horn turned them down for the first time they requested the case file. But when they returned with more crucial information, they actually agreed to let them review the file. So this was, they got the go-ahead, not only from police, law enforcement, also from the victims' families. And they worked with local investigators and victims' family members to piece together what might have happened to Patricia and Jesse. And they eventually launched a podcast called The Long Dance, which is an 8-part series, and it released in 2018, which drew a major spotlight to the case. If you're curious and you want to go check this out, I recommend. It's a ton of interviews. They have like a lot of phone interviews with people who were involved in the case. Some of the investigators, some people who knew the potential suspects, et cetera, et cetera. It's very long, but if you want to do the deep dive, you can
check we'll link that it out. Below for you to check out, because it's like 8 hours.
Yeah. Reportedly, Eric and Drew are the only ones outside of law enforcement who have seen the case file that contains several people of interest and three people who were never officially cleared. Two had been formally questioned by police. Only one was questioned after 2011 and is still alive. The other two have passed away.
Yeah, and this is the maddening part about this case is once you start hearing about these suspects, you're like, why on earth did they not go harder at these guys?
Yeah, they seem, all three of them seem problematic at best.
At best, yeah. Well, one suspect was James Brandon Ray, who went by Jimmy, who worked as an orderly at Patricia's nursing school. He was known as a ladies' man, married at the time, who had one son and couldn't hold down a job. He allegedly cheated on his wife with 6 different women. Police had been tipped off by an anonymous informant who claimed that Jimmy had been collecting every newspaper and interview about the case he could get his hands on and was obsessing over them. Red flags? He had also been known for impersonating a police officer by using a flashing red and blue light that he would place on his car. Another red flag. He also listened to police radios and owned a raincoat that looked like a police raincoat. At one point, he drove a Chrysler sedan that somewhat looked like a police car. Apparently, Jimmy would often visit the undeveloped suburbs where Jesse's car was found and put the fake police lights on his car to freak out the young adults or teenagers who use the area as a hookup spot. I mean,
yeah,
this is like
looks really
boom,
bad.
Boom, boom. Yeah, I mean, this lines up.
Mm-hmm.
And to make things worse, he also had a criminal record, including Grand Theft Auto going back to when he was 15 years old. But none of his offenses were violent, which doesn't mean a whole lot to me, honestly. I'm like,
things can escalate.
Yes. I mean, if he's getting Grand Theft Auto at age 15, chances are his crimes are going to escalate as he gets older. And then you couple that with these other 3 things.
Yeah, it's hard to just call those coincidences, especially when he's even known in the area screwing with people around that area.
Which, why is he doing that?
Well, yeah.
Why is he trying to like mess with people that are hooking up?
Yeah, you got nothing better to do on like right. Friday night?
Or he's jealous, or he doesn't, you know, he doesn't like his relationships with women. There's a lot of things there. Throughout his life, he violated his probation, was in and out of jail pretty consistently. And while he was being investigated for Grand Theft Auto crime around the time of the murders, an investigator discovered a wig, 2 pistols with blank rounds, a police badge, and keys to 2 lockers to Ward K in Watts Hospital, which is where he worked. But this was also the same ward where Patricia had worked. Reportedly on February 10th, just 2 days before the murders, Jimmy visited a neighbor who ran a roofing business. According to the neighbor, Jimmy told him that his car had gone stuck and he needed to borrow a rope. The neighbor wouldn't give it to him, claiming it was too weak to tow a vehicle, but Jimmy eventually stole it anyway. Allegedly, this was a similar type of rope to the one used in the murders. The length of rope then broke in half after trying to tow his car out of a ditch, and police later found the broken rope inside his car. After Jimmy was brought in for questioning and asked about the rope, he admitted that the rope found in his car belonged to him, but he did not admit to being involved in the murders, which is like, did they try to see if the rope matched up with the one that they found at the scene? Did they even try to look at that? It seems like something they could have looked at.
It is kind of a common rope too, Cecil rope. It's kind of like a smaller and twiny.
But couldn't they, somebody who's an expert on rope, could probably figure out if that rope was broken by towing his car out of the ditch, or it was broken for other reasons, or was it cut, or, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of different ways to forensically analyze rope.
Yeah. Also, just something I noticed, seems like a kleptomaniac. He steals a bunch of cars. He's even stealing this rope.
Yeah.
Rope is cheap.
Go to the hardware store, buy some rope.
It's not that expensive.
He gets a rush from it. He likes to just steal it.
Yeah.
After being questioned, he then sold that black Chrysler. Not sketchy at all. And during the sale, he allegedly mentioned the murders to the buyer. The buyer reported that Jimmy talked about the lengths of rope being cut into segments, specific knots that were tied between the victim's hands, and a call to the victim's families where the caller admitted they knew who committed the murders.
Granted, I mean, he could have been reading the newspapers or like kind of obsessed with the case.
True. He's just like a wannabe cop who's also stealing from her. Like, what's going on here? What is his deal? He also claimed he knew Patricia personally since he was taking classes at Watts and working as a nurse's assistant. He said that Patricia wasn't as innocent as people thought she was and that she was cheating on Jesse often, which... just spreading rumors. Yeah, what's going on
here?
I
don't believe this guy.
But according to Jimmy's wife, Jimmy said he didn't know Patricia at all, and he only knew specific details from the articles that he read. But he admitted to his wife that he had joined the search parties to look for the victims, and he lied that his search team had gotten close to where the bodies were eventually found, but they had taken a lunch break before they could find them. Which, to be fair to law enforcement, I can see that the more they dive into Jimmy, like, this guy's just a fucking liar.
Just wants to be involved in the case.
He wants to be like a hero or something. Mm-hmm. There's something really weird about him. But again, should he be completely discounted? I don't know. He told his six other girlfriends conflicting stories related to the murders. To one, he said he was a rescue worker. To another, he said he had once dated Patricia. But much, if not everything he had said, especially about his work at Watts or his relationship with Patricia, were just lies. Apparently, he often harassed Patricia at work. He never dated her. He would taunt her and follow her around the hospital. And in January 1971, the month before the murders happened, he was fired for not showing up to work. And as for an alibi, he often spent nights out of the house where his wife and son live, so his wife often didn't know where he was. Reportedly, he spent the night in question with one of his girlfriends, Laverne, which she later corroborated. However, he had dropped her off at her home around 11 p.m. He then showed up at Laverne's brother's place around midnight. There's some reports out there that say it was after midnight. But basically just saying he ran out of gas near Crossdale Golf Course and he needed an empty gas can, some money, and a ride to the gas station. And according to the brother, he agreed and ended up taking him to the back roads near the Crossdale Golf Course, near where Patricia and Jesse had parked. Like we mentioned before, Jimmy would often visit the undeveloped suburbs and put the fake police lights on his car to freak out the young adults or teenagers who were using that area to hook up in their vehicles. But it's unclear what Jimmy was actually doing out there on the night of February 12th. The other odd thing was that when the brother dropped Jimmy off at his car, Jimmy warned him not to get too close to his car and that he didn't need any help refueling. Like, no, I got it. Go, bye. Yeah. The brother told police that he had dropped Jimmy off at his car at around 12:30 a.m., so Jimmy's alibi did have a few gaps in time. Plus, Jimmy's mother apparently lived near the Duke Forest area where the bodies were discovered. And after Jimmy sold the car, police found it and searched it, but they found really nothing that really stuck out to them. And with nothing else to go on, the police ended up letting him go. Law enforcement was very divided on whether or not Jimmy was actually their guy. Was he involved? Some theorize he might have witnessed the abduction, which might explain his odd and, you know, pretty obsessive behavior towards the case. I think
maybe something to consider. I don't know. This guy seems like a compulsive liar and, it's hard to pin down what exactly is going on.
I have a hard time believing he could have pulled this off without leaving a bunch of evidence behind. You know what I mean?
He's kind of a dummy.
I think he's kind of a dummy and he can't keep his story straight and he's all over the place. And he would have been, if he had actually done this, he would have been caught very easily because they would have just probably through conversations with him, they would have been able to trip him up or he just would have been dumb and left something at the scene, but maybe not. I don't know. I don't know this guy beyond, you know, the articles that are written about him, but maybe he was cunning and smart and, you know, but the dude got caught stealing.
Yeah. You know, I don't think he's that
cunning
slick.
And slick is he?
Yeah.
Jimmy later left the state and failed to find consistent work over the years, and he got arrested a few more times for car theft. Once he even broke out of jail and went on the run, using aliases during his travels. After a time, he eventually returned to Durham, where he found work in a lab. He was later fired for stealing a hammer and not conducting the urinalysis test properly. He then found work as a carny and fell in love with a ride operator. Dude, what the?
It's just a crazy life.
What
it's
on
insane.
Earth? And he ended up getting married in 2005 and moved to North Carolina. And then a couple years later, Jimmy died in 2009. Yeah, he's just all over the place.
All over, man. Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, he's been caught for so much else. There's no, I don't think he could pull off something this intricate and disturbing, frankly, and yeah, get away with it. I don't think he could get away with something like
and
that.
And why would, and he's got so many instances that people know of him driving around as a fake police officer, just like messing with people.
Yeah.
This, whoever did this feels much more intelligent to me. Secretive, kind of a hiding in plain sight type of person, you know, devil in disguise, not Jimmy boy. Who's doing Grand Theft Auto, stealing a hammer. Like, dude.
Yeah.
There's no way this guy's pulling this off.
One thought I do have is that the actual killer knew Jimmy was screwing around out there and thought that would be a great cover for me. Since this idiot's out there, I can kind of pin it on him a little bit. That's just a thought that I have. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a valid thought for sure.
So moving on to the next major person of interest in the case, this was Dr. James Stephen Walter Wilson, and he was a doctor specializing in emergency medicine and cardiovascular disease, not to be confused with another Dr. James Wilson, who was a beloved surgeon in the same community. Dr. James Stephen Walter Wilson was known as intelligent, vindictive, violent, angry, and arrogant. He lived a quarter mile from where the bodies were found. During the investigation, police failed to ask him where he was on the night of the murders. Later, they interviewed those who knew him to piece together his whereabouts. That seems like a huge screw up that they failed to ask him his alibi.
Yeah.
I mean, you can watch any crime procedural show and every time, Law and Order, dung, dung, where were you on the night of February?
Right.
Like they always
detective work
that.
101.
Right.
Where were you?
I don't know how they screwed that up.
I feel like because of the time period, this could have been one of those circumstances, you know, because he's a doctor, he's got
respected
the title.
In the community.
I feel like I know this for a fact because my grandfather, not a medical doctor, had a doctorate,
mm-hmm.
made sure everybody knew that he had a doctorate.
Doctor, yeah.
And it was like, it was very much this like kind of egotistical title thing. Like, mm-hmm. well, I have a doctorate. So he'd have like, he'd sign his name, doctor, and then his name on everything. Just, and like
yeah,
people
I'm gonna go back to school just so I can do that.
I know, right? just to have the title, yeah. Doctor so-and-so.
Yeah.
Like, dude, you're not a medical, only yeah. medical doctors do that
right.
these days.
My mom doesn't even, my mom is a, was, she's now retired. She was an ER doctor. She doesn't even.
Does she sign all of her like papers for
no,
unless the gym it was as like doctor? Yeah. Or so.
No, only if it was specifically related to a medical form or her
right.
job or something, then it would be Dr. Karen, et cetera. But
yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So I don't.
But can't you see that like back in like the 70s, they'd be. I'm Dr. Hold on.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. James Stephen Walter Wilson.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah. I think they're
talk
might be
to me
that,
like that,
yeah.
you little puny officer.
Yeah.
Who do you
or
think
they,
you were?
They brought him in and they knew he was like, oh, this is a doctor. It's probably not our guy. So they didn't really. They're
take
like,
it
oh, we're
seriously.
Just going through the motions
right.
here. Apparently, what they pieced together later was that he was supposed to be at a dinner party that night hosted by another doctor. He showed up late, sometime around midnight, possibly later. Witnesses claimed he appeared shifty and paranoid, looking out the window and pacing. What is like
odd?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
He shows up late to the party
and then acting like super paranoid, like a way to be completely like, obvious.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Wait, what are they doing outside?
Yeah, big sweat drop.
Is that
coming
a police
those.
Car?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Come on, man.
Or he's self-medicating, possibly.
There
he's writing
go.
Prescriptions for himself.
Yeah. After the bodies were found, Dr. Wilson and her friend allegedly went to see the oak tree out in Duke Forest. A witness reported that Dr. Wilson began saying odd things out near the tree, piecing together where and how things occurred. Again, this could be you're reading the newspaper reports, you kind of know what's going on. The friend with Dr. Wilson suspected he knew maybe a bit too much about the crimes, though. On top of this, Dr. Wilson published, along with another doctor, this is crazy, but this is for maybe establishing Dr. Wilson's character. So they published this textbook titled The Anatomical Basis of Medical Practice. And I remember my mom's textbooks back in school. These are like huge. They're really detailed. You spend kind of a lot of time compiling the information for these, but this is hilarious what they end up doing to this. So in the book, they ended up using naked female models in lewd positions for some of their anatomical diagrams. So not all of them, it was just like a few one-offs every once in a while, but some ended up calling it the, quote, pornographic anatomy book. And the photographer, who was Peter Goland, was a famous glamour photographer from California who often photographed pinup models. He might have even worked for Playboy at one point. But on top of this, the odd sexually suggestive language used in the text mentioned things like using women during sexual intimacy to, quote, study female anatomy. The text even joked about how unfortunate it was that they couldn't reveal where the models lived.
What the fuck is this?
So just completely, it's just some misogynist making what they think is like a cheeky a medical textbook, but just comes off really weird and disturbing and gross. But the response to this is hilarious. It's the 70s. We're getting a little progressive out here. So a boycott was organized by the Association of Women in Science.
That's right, baby.
Yeah, right. And after the book stirred up enough controversy, it was soon withdrawn from the market. Many professors and students requested refunds. So just they totally screwed this book over for good reason. Dr. Wilson defended the textbook, saying that it was the publisher's fault and that he was a victim of a quote-unquote witch hunt.
What? It's a... Yeah, they just accidentally posted all those naked women in there. I don't know how they got in there.
Yeah.
I didn't write it. Oh, wait, I did.
Your name's on the cover, man. You're responsible for this. He and the other authors thought they were writing this like witty, engaging, and funny book. But because of the controversy, the book has also become this odd collector's item and now sells for anywhere between like $450 to $4,500. You can look. You'll find it on eBay and
everybody's
stuff.
Everybody's going to be searching eBay right now.
Yeah.
See if it's out there.
If any of you sick freaks buy this book, hit us up and tell us how ridiculous it is. But it's so weird to me. And you could write it off as like, oh, it's a different time. But to me, even then, it was clearly misogynistic. And there was an immediate response to this. And they took it off the shelves.
Well, so. Why is he calling it a textbook? What, he's like, really thinks he's going to get this in the curriculum?
You know what I think it was? Because when you think about the 70s, it was still a time of where most women, as we see here, they go into nursing and only the men were smart enough to become doctors. So all the men who are purchasing these textbooks are these like they're trying to be cheeky and perverted and like try and play into like all the men are doctors. So why don't we make it a little fun? I think that's that's my theory on why they tried this, but it was just
well,
stupid.
It didn't fly then.
No, yeah.
It certainly wouldn't fly now.
Yeah. So on top of this, Dr. Wilson also reportedly violently threatened the life of one of the activists, Dr. Estelle Ramey. She was the one who boycotted the book and helped remove it from the market. So this wasn't just, I love that. That goes completely against my point too, where there were female doctors out there, but I was more proposing that it's like that was the stereotype.
Yeah.
Like all women become nurses, all men become doctors. But
now there's men that are nurses.
Yeah. And they're
it's
great
like meet
nurses.
The Fockers.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. After her death in 2006, Dr. Ramey had made such an impact during her career that she was eulogized by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's legendary.
So she made quite an impact during her life. So Dr. Wilson's vile interactions with women continued. At one point, he assaulted and threatened to kill a fellow female student in a parking lot at Duke University because they didn't want to date him.
Yeah, they're so like, some, you fucking creep. Yeah, what are you doing?
Definitely some incel energy here.
But the fact that he's threatening to kill is very concerning.
Yes, absolutely.
It shows there's a monster underneath that.
Definitely.
That white coat.
Yeah. And confident enough to do that in a university parking lot. Like not even in private. This is out in the open.
Which I think could lend some credence to my comment about he thinks he's above law enforcement to some extent. If he's just out there spewing this, he's putting out tech, he just kind of thinks he can do whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he's big bad doctor.
Yep. This will soon come to bite him in the ass though, because
hopefully literally bite him.
Yeah.
Nice.
Take a big chunk out.
Takes
a
chunk out of his ass.
So while married with children, he then did the same thing to the head of the anatomy department at Duke University. And this was finally a big enough infraction to where he was later placed in the psychiatric ward at Duke.
That's great. I hope they restrained his ass. And like,
yeah.
He went kicking and screaming all the way to the psychiatric ward.
Yeah. Then he apparently, while in the psychiatric ward, he found God.
Of course he did.
Yep. And was released from the ward.
That's why they released him. He found
God. He was just like, yeah, I'm a reformed individual. I'm better now.
He says, I burned that textbook. I got my Bible now. Yes. We're all good. I'm right with Jesus now.
Yeah. It's and that's like such an old play in the playbook, right? But clearly he wasn't reformed because not long after he threatened to kill his own wife, but admitted he wouldn't know what to do with her teeth, meaning he planned to dispose of her in a way so she couldn't be identified. So now he's making clear, it's not even like threatening someone's life here. He's now also admitting to like, I kind of fantasize about planning this.
Yeah.
Even if he's just joking, like that's a crazy thing to say to someone, especially your own wife.
Well, he's clearly read some books on human decomposition.
There you go.
So he's concerned that how am I going to get rid of the dental records that are me?
Yep.
That would be left.
He then, on top of this, physically assaulted his wife with a hot kettle in front of their two sons, and she and the sons fled to her sister's house. After this, he was ordered to return to the psychiatric hospital.
When are we going to send this fucker to jail?
Right. I mean,
he needs to spend a night in the clanker.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe that will... He'll find God there.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
Yeah. So, and then even from the psychiatric hospital, he found where his wife and his sons were. And then he sent horrible letters to his son saying really disparaging things about his wife and how unfit she was to be their mother, there are things that I just don't even want to say. So by 1976, he was divorced and was married to his second wife.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. One day, he locked himself in their house in Memphis with his stepson, and it took police and hostage negotiators 5 hours to resolve the situation. I think it was like at 4 a.m. they finally finished. Apparently, he admitted he was acting strange because he was just too drunk, and it was basically left at that. And I think that's a bit more of the police being like, yeah, he's a doctor. We'll leave him alone. He was just drunk. It was a one-off. But yeah, he was never charged with that. It was just an incident that happened.
Yeah, that's nuts.
When revisiting Dr. Wilson as a person of interest, investigators noticed that all of his female victims were blonde, and Patricia Mann was also blonde. So in 1971, Dr. Wilson, by his own admission, had reportedly been teaching a class in respiratory therapy where he first met Patricia. He then admitted he had tried to date Patricia multiple times, but she rejected him. So he tried to ruin her education and get her thrown out of school. The weird part is that investigators couldn't find any evidence that he had ever taught this class or had ever come across Patricia during her education.
So which you would think there would be some evidence there. They'd be able to find some trail. Record.
Yeah, of course. It'd be like, he's teaching this class. University keeps all those records. Who's teaching what? And then what is it called? Like the roster sheet of the students would be there, right?
Right.
It'd be pretty apparent. So are we dealing with another compulsive liar or something here?
Well, he just sounds like a drunk fool.
That might be it.
That is just all over the place. He's self-medicating himself to deal with. He's clearly got some psychiatric issues going on. Mm. He's, you know, too smart for his own good and thinks he's like fucking invincible and can just do whatever the fuck he wants. There's no repercussions to his actions.
Yep.
And so to me, he just seems too reckless to, again, carry out something like this. Could he have been in like a rare sober moment and done this? I just don't see him doing this, you know, like there was some level of planning to this, the location, knowing where they were, like, what was he just out drunk one night, you know, on Lover's Lane, just hanging out and then saw them and then just happened to have rope on him and go and do that. I don't know. Is it possible? Sure. I think he's capable of it, but do I think he's the one who did it? I don't know that there's enough here to convince me of that, but.
Yeah, someone also admitting to be like, yeah, I tried to date her and then I tried to ruin her life and her education here, get her kicked out of school. And then the police realizing that that's not true at all. I think that reads to me as someone who's trying to inject themselves into the investigation.
But I know there's some, you know, further incidents that you know, could lean a little bit more in the direction of, you know, violence as similar to what Patricia and Jesse went through. So I think he's certainly a person of interest that should be looked into. It's just if he's just throwing out lies and they're not able to back up anything that he's saying, and it's just crazy that there wouldn't be any even breadcrumbs that lead in that direction whatsoever.
Right.
You know, they can't even find that he ever met her, or other than what he said, you know.
Right.
And what he said was pretty specific too.
Yeah. By his own admission, he was also questioned by police in the strangulation of a woman named Betty Yale Brown. This was a university student in Kansas in 1961. She had been strangled in her car with her own bra strap. She was not robbed or sexually assaulted, similar to the murders of Patricia and Jesse. Her case remains unsolved. When investigators tried to corroborate this information with police in Kansas, they said Dr. Wilson had never been questioned. Investigators began to suspect he might have been a consistent liar who wanted to participate in the case. He had also claimed he had been in New York on 9/11, on the ground helping survivors, and he admitted he was involved in the murders of several more local women, along with other publicized crimes and tragedies.
What?
Yes, this, he just seems off his rocker.
Yes, really. I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
He is not in a, you know, stable frame of mind.
Yeah. So according to estranged family members, they believe Dr. Wilson suffered from undiagnosed schizophrenia. As far as I can find, he was never officially diagnosed, but that's coming from estranged family members. Some said he was brilliant but dangerously delusional, and that his hallucinations and paranoia resulted in his bizarre behavior. I could believe that. His own sister even called him a pathological liar with a mental disturbance, but ultimately she didn't believe he was capable of murder. He later retired, lived alone in an apartment, and passed away in 2009 from heart failure. When the investigation was reopened, although Dr. Wilson had already passed, witnesses still talked about him to investigators with a significant amount of fear in their voices.
And rightfully so. I mean, yeah,
seems like a really scary guy.
Yeah, anybody that's had encounters with this guy, notice we didn't say there's any like good stories, good memories, good positive interactions with him. He's just completely, just out of it.
Yeah.
And but this, you know, so they're like, all right, well, possibility, again, he's passed, so there's not really much more you can do there. But for investigators, the suspect that stood out the most was a doctor at Watts Hospital named Robert Carl Britt. And this is the only serious person of interest in this case that's still alive today. The Long Dance podcast goes into great detail with interviews and eyewitness accounts against Dr. Britt, but from the lack of substantial physical evidence, Dr. Britt has never been indicted. So again, if you're interested in checking out that series in more detail and check out those interviews, we'll have a link for that 8-part series. But it all started back when an odd call was made to Jesse's mom, Hilda, in the mid-90s. And traced to a local office plaza on Hillendale Road, which is less than a mile from where the couple was abducted. The caller claimed that they had killed her son, and when she asked who it was, the voice responded, quote, "Dr. Britt, I killed your son." But police did not bring Dr. Britt in for questioning at the time. Detectives also discovered that James, or Jimmy Ray, the other suspect, shortly after being released from jail, had found work with Dr. Britt in a medical lab in Durham later on. If you remember, we were just talking about that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Some suspect that if the theory of two offenders was true, it's possible the two might have been Jimmy Ray and Dr. Robert Britt, men who both had a history of violence, were in the area at the time of the murders, and were known to impersonate police officers. So Dr. Britt, he came from a wealthy, influential family. He was a valedictorian of his high school, an Eagle Scout.
Same
I think
here.
It's very, very important when talking about knots. Nobody's better at tying knots than an Eagle Scout.
There you go. I'm actually really bad at tying knots. I forgot.
Have
them
you
all.
Said you're an Eagle Scout?
I am an Eagle Scout. Yeah, I think I've mentioned that before.
I was a Cub Scout.
Nice, nice.
And I don't even know if I got to Weebelow or not. I was a Boy Scout for a little while.
Yeah.
I wish I would have stuck with it, though. Some good skills.
It was a good time. Some good memories. Unfortunately, like a lot of my friends dropped out by Boy Scouts.
Eagle Scout's hard.
It was, yeah.
It's not a walk in the park. You got to commit to it.
No. Especially when I was 18 or 17, because you got to do it before you're 18. I was like...
Don't you have to do like a big project at the end?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard when you're a 17-year-old boy to be like, I gotta do a project? Like, it was really tough. Yeah. It was tough.
Did you get your Eagle at 17 or 18?
I got it. Funny enough, I got all my papers signed like the day before I turned 18.
Nice.
Yeah. Cause I think you have to do it before you're 18. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Eagles.
Yeah. Like, me too.
Oh, yeah. Daniel.
Daniel's, yeah, Daniel's an Eagle Scout too. Yeah.
I got mine at 15.
Yeah. Also, welcome Tom to the podcast. Oh, that I switch out. Yeah.
Sorry. My bad.
But yeah. Yeah. Tom, also an Eagle Scout. A lot of work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would gladly do it again. It was, you learn a lot, honestly.
You do.
I agree. And I think especially in these times, a lot of those skills are good to have.
That's true.
You know, shit hits the fan and we got to go off grid. You're going to at least have a leg up.
I can survive a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, add a few supplementary skills in there and you'll be good to go.
I mean, between the two of us, we could start a fire, build a shelter out of just nothing.
Dude, we were having... Unironically, this exact conversation when I helped out on Seth before we went on our break, where they were doing like community questions, and one of the questions was like, "What would your roles be if you were like all stranded on an island?" And it quite literally boiled down to just like Janelle and Kendall being like, "Tom, you will do everything, and we'll help out like where we need to.
We'll gather, you build." That's great. Yeah. No, I think. I mean, I know the Boy Scout organization's got.
It had
a rough time.
A very rough time. And their numbers dwindled because of it for very good reason, I think. I even remember you do that final meeting when you make Eagle.
Yeah.
And I did mention that. I was like, I'm highly disturbed at things that are going on within our organization. So that was kind of my like farewell. I got to at least say something about it. But now they're known as what? They're not even called Boy Scouts.
It's just Scouts of America. Yeah, because now it's co-ed.
Anybody. So. Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. Right.
But Dr. Britt, so back to him. Sorry, I took a little side road there on Scouts. Good old Scouts over here. Well, Dr. Britt, he was a Sea Scout as well.
Which is just, I think it's just Boy Scouts, but it's more oriented in like the navals. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like the Sea Org for Scientology. So he was an Eagle Scout and a Sea Scout, and he was on the football team, valedictorian. This guy's just crushing every life goal a young teen could possibly have.
Mm-hmm.
He then went to UNC at Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and after graduating, he became a doctor. He got married in 1957 and he fathered a daughter. He also had a suspicious incident involving the death of a man about a decade before the Valentine's Day murders. On September 9th, 1961, early in the morning around 1:40 a.m., Dr. Britt was on his way to Atlanta to attend a family wedding. A mill worker was walking alongside a two-lane highway near a bridge, and according to Dr. Britt, the man was standing in a frozen position along the bridge when he approached. At the last minute, the man tried to dive out of the way, and Dr. Britt claimed he tried to avoid him, but he hit the man head on and carried him on the hood of the car for over 70 yards before he rolled over the car and off the back. The man died as a result of his injuries, and Dr. Britt was never charged with a crime. Although he was sued in a wrongful death lawsuit that resulted in $3,250 payout, which is chump change for this doctor.
Yeah.
The mill worker did have a wife and kids, and it took his wife 3 years to settle the cost of burying her husband.
God.
Got totally screwed. Dr. Britt also had a history of poor behavior and anger at work. While working as a doctor, Dr. Britt apparently flashed a gun. He just gun-toed. Good God.
At the hospital?
Yeah.
That's
underneath
crazy.
His white doctor's coat. This dude's strapped. He's like, what'd you say?
Yeah, why?
That's
so
like,
crazy.
We're unarmed, sir.
That's so unhinged.
No, this guy's a straight just gangster at the hospital. He's armed. He's also going around slashing hospital staff's tires, allegedly, throwing work clothes into dumpsters, and just vandalizing property.
Total menace.
Yeah. He was also accused of sexually harassing multiple nurses, but this wasn't reported until after the fact. And most of his behavior was just ignored or swept under the rug. At worst, he received minor punishments, a little slap on the wrist and don't do that again. And he's like,
what'd you say?
Dude, this guy's, yeah, a menace. Good God, Dr. Britt. He clearly forgot his Boy Scout principles.
Yeah, seriously.
Take his Eagle Scout away.
Strip him, yeah. Strip him of all his merit badges and his Eagle Scout rank.
Ridiculous. Okay, so then it goes on. On January 12th, 1995, Dr. Britt forced a woman off the road in a fit of road rage and then physically assaulted her. In court, he claimed he acted in self-defense. Which, how did he make that work? What? As a result, his medical license was revoked. But 3 years later, a review board reviewed his case again and determined it was a, quote, mutual assault. And he got his license back.
How is that even any better?
Yeah, really? No, it sounds like he knew the people on the board.
And yep.
It's like, all right, dude, I did my time.
He's like, he's just pulling his piece out constantly.
I don't know why. Just imagine he has like a revolver or something. He's just like
a 45 like revolver. Yeah.
Good God, this guy's insane.
Yeah.
On another occasion, he was charged with resisting arrest. And in 2000, he assaulted someone at the racket and swim club. So he's just going around bullying people, just being a complete asshole.
Yeah. And clearly violent too.
He takes it to that level.
I don't know if these are like anger episodes, if he has anger issues, kind of how I read it, but yeah, he'll take it to violence.
But police noticed that he fit the original profile from the 70s. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And an investigator uncovered an incident that was not found on Dr. Britt's criminal record. In 1973, a group of kids had been hitchhiking on the side of the road, but no one picked them up. So they started flipping off and, you know, cursing at cars as they passed, and apparently Dr. Britt had been driving one of these cars. So of course, you know, Dr. Britt, he sees this going on, he's like, I'm pulling over and I'm teaching these kids a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently he pulled over to the shoulder, got out of the car, pulled out his gun, and then he told the kids that he was a police officer and ordered them to get into his car. The children refused, and even one of the kids like pulled out a knife, was like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they obviously knew what was up. They're like, you're not a cop.
Right.
What are you talking about? Seeing that he wasn't in control of the situation, Dr. Britt returned to his car and then left. The kids then wrote down his license plate and walked to a nearby business where they called the police to report the man. They mentioned that they might have come across a dangerous undercover officer driving a Pontiac, and they gave the license plate number as well. And as it turned out, they were like straight from the license plate, like, yeah, this guy's not a cop at all. And the car was registered to Dr. Robert Britt, which good for these kids for, you know, obviously not the smartest thing to go flipping off cars and cursing, but it's like.
Yeah, or walking alongside a highway, also not.
No, not safe.
Yeah.
But I mean, we all do dumb shit when we're young.
Yeah.
Police noticed his address was located near the Crossdale Golf Course, near where Jesse's car had been abandoned. On top of that, Dr. Britt's brother's address was traced to a trailer near where the bodies were discovered. So it was obvious that if anybody would be familiar with this area, it would be Dr. Britt.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he denied any connection to the murders or crime involving the young hitchhikers. The hitchhikers did later identify Dr. Britt in a photograph. Investigators also discovered that Patricia Mann had been his student at one point. So here we have an actual connection being made. Yeah. He also did not have an alibi for the night in question. Apparently, he had tickets to a basketball game in Charlotte, North Carolina, but he did not attend. Another source placed him at Watts Hospital that night, which meant he would have passed the subdivision where Patricia and Jesse were that night. So it's very possible. I mean, he can't vouch for where he was.
Right.
So what was he doing? In December of 1970, Dr. Britt's father had been diagnosed with leukemia and passed away in April 1971. Some suspect that this might have been a stressor in his life, which really increased a lot of that anger at the time. Sergeant Tim Bowers, who originally worked the case in the 70s, investigated Dr. Britt for 2 years following the murders. He even brought him in for questioning at one point. I wish so bad we had some interrogation footage of this guy.
Oh.
Want to see what this guy was like in real life, but What was odd was that while specifically talking about the hitchhiking incident, Dr. Britt randomly said that the crime was probably committed by, quote, the same guy who killed those kids a few years ago. When asked to clarify, since the detectives hadn't even mentioned the Valentine's Day murders case, he said, quote, that nursing student and her boyfriend. Very specific, which obviously means he's referring to Patricia and Jesse.
Creepy that they hadn't even mentioned that case too, and that's immediately where he went to.
Yeah, something is very off about this guy, and when police finally reinvestigated the case into the hitchhikers and questioned Dr. Britt, he began flirting with one of the female detectives, Detective Dawn Hunter. And when she tried to redirect back to the questioning, he refused to make eye contact with her or speak to her. He only responded to the male detective, Investigator Horn, who she was with. Throughout the interview, detectives noticed how uncomfortable Dr. Britt appeared, and he struggled throughout the questions but ended up not giving them any information. The detectives then mentioned he could be cleared if he took a polygraph test and also if they took a DNA swab from him. And Dr. Britt just excused himself from the room after this for a moment. The detectives believed he needed to compose himself since he was worried about this offer. And I guess when he returned, he gave them his card and told them to contact him. But when the detectives returned to their vehicle, they got a call from Dr. Britt's lawyer telling them that he would not be submitting DNA or participating in a polygraph. So
that's basically where that ends. He pulled the you could talk to my lawyer card. And
I think it's very suspicious. And I think, I mean, out of the few possible suspects, he's actually confirmed to have having contact with Patricia. And the statement about knowing about the murder case before it was even mentioned is all very, because it's almost like he's thinking, he's like, what do these guys know? What's the real purpose here?
Yeah.
Because they keep trying to like refer me to the hitchhikers, which they're clearly using that incident to try to like get to the real questions they want to ask in this kind of roundabout way. And he kind of, I think, sniffed it out a little bit. And he was like, oh, and then just flat out asking for a polygraph and DNA. He's like, hell no.
Yep. Yeah. He definitely seems like, I mean, he's got to be prime suspect, right?
Totally. I mean, I think they're spot on with this. I think he seems very, very, I think he's capable of doing this. I think he's smart enough to do it.
Yeah.
He's unhinged enough.
Yep.
So I think he's a pretty strong suspect. But as the decades have passed, methods of collecting and testing DNA have improved significantly. Because I think we all go back to like, what about the rope that was around? You know, somebody put the rope on there. So is there possible DNA on there from the perpetrator?
Right.
Well, there's a method called the MVAC retrieval system, which was introduced in the 90s. And it's used to extract DNA evidence. The MVAC is a wet vacuum. Just like your shop back that you clean your car.
Yeah. My upholstery cleaner.
Yeah.
Which is funny because it kind of does, in a way, kind of look like that to some degree. It's got the hose attachment where they suck things up.
Works virtually the same way.
Yeah.
But it's a DNA collection device that uses a spray solution and vacuum pressure to collect DNA from porous or rough materials. And only 80 of these machines exist in the world, which is wild. 40 of them are in the U.S., Guilford County, North Carolina had gotten their hands on one and let the investigators in Durham use the machine for this case in 2018.
So just important to note that the numbers, the 80 machines that exist, that is reported from a news article that was published in 2018, I believe. So those numbers might be a little bit different nowadays, but they're still very rare machines. Are you looking?
I imagine they're pretty expensive too. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that there's not just like news articles.
Now have 100.
Yeah. Whoever manufactures these, like, hello, everybody. We now have 1,000 in circulation.
Yeah.
I think it's a, you know, A, you got to manufacture it. B, you got to know how to use it properly.
Because
you obviously got to, there's a method to doing this. But the machine was originally designed to determine possible pathogens in food samples. But then it was later used for DNA, and it works like we were just talking about, handheld carpet cleaner. And the idea is that it can extract DNA from difficult places. In this case, the machine could potentially pull DNA from the fibrous ropes used to tie the victims. And luckily, these ropes have been preserved and protected over the years, which can't always say that.
Yeah. Often, I mean, we've seen in the past, you know, few months, some of the cases we've covered, losing evidence constantly, especially for cases that are decades old.
So at least we have it.
Yeah.
And as Detective Horn explained it, he said, quote, "It's basically an industrial type of carpet cleaner. It sprays a solution out, and that fluid is captured and condensed down onto a filter. And then all the DNA profiles on that have to be extrapolated." And, you know, if you're watching, you see a picture of this thing. It's, yeah, it looks like one, a little carpet cleaner, obviously a little bit more technical than that. Smaller tubes and such and some gauges, but works virtually the same way. Investigators figured they should use this method on the ropes found at the crime scene, hoping there would be forensic evidence left behind. They also collected a straw that Dr. Britt had used to gather his DNA for a potential match, which good move there.
Yeah.
Investigator Horn called the test a Hail Mary, which I think they know there's a, you know, the chances that there's a viable DNA sample on there is probably slim to none after all these years, but it's worth a try. And unfortunately, it came back and they weren't able to pull any DNA evidence from the ropes. And so it's very disappointing because there's not much else, unfortunately. But Tim Horn believes they might have another shot once DNA collection technology improves. In February 2019, Major Tim Horn retired after 29 years of service at the Orange County Sheriff's Department. So, you know, well-deserved. I'm happy for him and thankful that he put in so much time on this case.
Yeah, and I do want to point out, I think when this crime occurred, just to put the time into perspective, Tim Horn was like, I think he says it at some point, he was like, I was like 5 years old when the murder occurred. And then it was like kind of surreal to be working that case so many years after the fact. So just to keep that in mind, that
a lot of time passed. Yeah. So although the MVAC test was unsuccessful, the crew from the Long Dance claimed that they plan on continuing their work with local law enforcement, hoping for any new leads in Patricia and Jesse's case. And as of time of this recording, there have been no new major developments in the case, although this case is permanently open. Tim Bowers, the original detective assigned to the case, was confident, even years after the fact, that Dr. Robert Carl Britt was responsible for the murders. Again, police weren't able to gather enough physical evidence to indict Dr. Britt, but many believe he did murder Patricia Mann and Jesse McBain. And today, he is the only living suspect involved in the case. Investigators have sarcastically called him the, quote, "the good doctor" over the years. His career in medicine spanned decades despite his behavior, and he ended up retiring in July of 2017 in Durham. At least he's not practicing anymore. My God.
Yeah.
He then moved to Florida, as most retirees do, where he's believed to reside in today. Although over 50 years have passed since the Valentine's Day murders, many remain hopeful that the perpetrator, or perhaps again, there's also possibly there's somebody else involved in this, will finally be brought to justice. But again, if you have any information or possible tips out there, you can call NC Wanted at 1-866-439-2683 or the Orange County Sheriff's Department at 919-644-3050, and we'll link their website below. But yeah, I think it's difficult because two seem very unlikely. Jimmy, I mean, maybe Jimmy was involved, possibly, but I don't know. He seems like
he loose screw it up. Yeah. And that goes straight with the psychological profile, right? That said, they would think this killer would be too particular and wouldn't risk having someone like Jimmy completely screw it all up. So I think, I don't know, where are you at? I think I buy the single culprit theory, even though it would be way more difficult. I think whoever, you know, pulled this off without getting caught must have been like very, very particular and very well planned in this. That's where I'm at. I don't know if you disagree, if you think there's two.
I don't know. I just am like, if it was Dr. Britt, he just did this one murder.
That is the weird part. Yeah.
And maybe he did it and he's like, got away with it, essentially, right? Or he was just paranoid that he was going to be caught for the rest of his life.
There was that weird instance of the second one happening the year after that wasn't reported on until later. They kind of had to go back and they got the phone call from the other officer who then said, yeah, there was a near identical abduction, but the couple got away. So maybe there was at least one other known instance of this.
Could have tried again. It failed. So you cut it off.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Possibly. Yeah. I mean, to me, it seems like the most likely scenario here.
Yeah.
It does seem like whoever did this had some medical knowledge to some extent. I mean, but it's like, why'd they murder them the way that they did? Such so it's a kind of an odd,
sadistic
yeah. game to them, which maybe that's exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But why, you know, and was it because they were envious of their relationship? They're just cold and heartless and don't want to see anybody having that. You know, again, there was like the Zodiac Killer. There's a lot of Lovers Lane murders out there over the years. There's a lot of killers that use that as a motivation to kill because they either had bad experiences with romantic partners, they weren't able to have romantic partners, and so therefore they went after romantic couples, and I think that's a possibility. It seems, yeah, I don't know. It seems like it had to have been one of the doctors, in my opinion. I think they're very close with Dr. Britt, and they just
can't get the evidence. Yeah,
because I think something else would have surfaced. Somebody would have said something if there was some random person. You know, I guess it could be a drifter or something like that who was just passing through. But then,
also the sheer fact that Dr. Britt lived near the abduction site,
right,
and then had a his brother, or was it his mother?
His brother.
Lived right where the bodies were found. It's like, oof.
Is that just a weird coincidence, or is there... I mean, I think if you look at the statistics, I think usually victims are found fairly close to their, you know, killer's locations, and a lot of unsolved cases like that.
Yeah.
So...
Was he the only one that was confirmed to have that connection? Besides, I think Jimmy worked like as a orderly or something.
Yeah, he may have like crossed. There wasn't one to really confirm.
Yeah, allegedly he was like kind of bothering her at work. So he also had some contact, but so did Dr. Britt confirm that she was in one of his classes.
Do you see Dr. Britt getting Jimmy involved?
Maybe. They did work together later, and I think the investigators saw that, which put them on the radar to both of them. Because what are the chances of that happening?
I feel like it'd be pretty slim, but I think in this case it might just work because of where they both worked and the relationship with each other. I don't know, Jimmy just seems like such a liability.
Yeah, buffoon
for him. But maybe, I mean, who knows? Because it could have been the one dumb thing that he did do was have Jimmy involved and was paranoid all these years that Jimmy was going to break or somehow call him out and put him, you know.
That's a good point.
On the line for this. But yeah, this one is just a real mystery. I mean, I think police are probably on the right track. They just don't have enough to. And they were hoping they were going to be able to pull some DNA and hopefully have it linked back to Dr. Britt.
Yeah. What do you think about that phone call? The one where it was, I killed your son. My name's Dr. Britt. Do you buy that? We've come across cases where people are just weirdos and they just call in like crank call.
Why would he do that though?
Yeah. Why confess and say your name like that?
Or somebody's... I don't know, somebody's pretending to be him, or I don't know, Jimmy? If Jimmy's involved?
Yeah, maybe someone involved trying to out the other person, maybe. But this was in the 90s, and it was never really followed up on by police, so that either meant like they kind of just scoffed at it, or they did look into it, and there was just nothing substantial there.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, I go back to the very beginning, too. It doesn't seem like the crime scene was secured properly. There was people walking all over the place. There likely was more evidence that either got destroyed or covered up or was missed because the scene just wasn't handled the way that it probably should have been, to where they could preserve as much evidence around that tree as possible.
Yeah.
Because I mean, how do they answer the question of how did they get there?
Right. That's why no tire tracks, no footprints they could find.
So they were walked out there, but why? I still struggle with motive. Other than this is a psychopath, game.
Yeah, true.
Or they
had a vendetta.
The theory that makes the most sense to me is Patricia was obviously a very attractive person and you know, well-liked by everybody, and some creepy guy tried to make advances towards her. She denied them because obviously she's in love with Jesse, and this person just flipped and then was kind of stalking her, possibly learned that they were out there or was following them that evening. Because it is interesting that it's on Valentine's Day. But I also think it's possible that this is somebody completely unknown that is either dead or out there still that just has evaded police. But I understand why they ended up the place that they did, because where else do you go? I mean, it could just be some random crime of opportunity. It could be some other type of serial killer was in their region and moved. I mean, there's infinite possibilities here, but
yeah.
I think Dr. Britt makes the most sense.
I think he does too.
But yeah, let us know your thoughts on this one. I'm at a loss here. I mean, ultimately I would, for their families, I'd hope that they would one day be able to figure this out, because it feels like it's right there. They're just missing that one little piece. And maybe it's some DNA they just can't pull from that rope that they will
eventually
in the next couple of years.
Awesome if they could.
I guarantee you the technology is going to get better, and it'll be, I can imagine in my mind in the future, we won't be talking about DNA extraction technology and equivalenting that to a carpet cleaner. You know what I mean? Like, doesn't that sound kind of like in some ways a little ridiculous? Like,
yeah,
my carpet cleaner used to pull stains out of my rug for my pets. They're using a similar type of machine, which I get it. The technology makes sense, and I'm super grateful that it's there. I just think, like, there's going to be some type of, I feel like, robotic. I mean, they have nanobots inside people's bodies doing surgery. Like, there'll be something that will be able to crawl the surface of that rope and be able to locate
where something is. I also considered that too, because if you look at a length of rope, which, you know, could be X, Y, and Z long, and they have multiple, if you look at the pictures, they have multiple pieces of rope. Where do you even begin to use that machine on it? If you're just looking at it if you're like, I don't know where there could be forensic evidence along this that could be the culprits, right? So yeah, I think maybe a part of it would be identifying where on the rope you'd have a better shot of
some type of scanning feature that could locate the exact location.
Because like, where do you even
right? You're just running that like little wand over the top of it,
yeah,
all up and down, and you're just kind of going in blind, hoping that it just happens to, you know, suck something up. But
and then is this potentially destroying evidence? I don't know how it works exactly.
It is also worth noting the cost of it, though, too, because I don't. You might have already looked it up, so I apologize if I'm just saying something you already know. But on MVAC's website, individual units are $48,000 a pop, but then samples per sample is $98, whereas a regular sample for DNA testing is $2.
Yeah,
so you also got to really figure expensive. If you have 100 samples you're going to go through, you're going to rack up.
The whole rope's going to cost thousands to do.
Oh, God. Yeah. So that's it's just kind of, the logistics of running that machine across all the rope that they have would just be,
I think there's a lot of cases where just current technology is limiting our capabilities of solving it. And as long as we keep the evidence preserved, I think that's my biggest worry, is that this rope will continue to deteriorate and the samples could also do the same, that they're, if they're able to preserve the evidence for long enough, that one day we will have the technology that's going to unlock a lot of answers. And like, again, if we are able to figure out who it was and that person's dead, we can't like bring them to court still, obviously, but at least there's answers for the family that they, because a lot of it's just the not knowing is the most painful part of it.
Yeah.
And being able to have that answer of what happened, the sort of the complete story of who did this, what happened, can maybe help bring some peace sometimes. But But yeah, it's really tough. I hope that the family eventually gets justice in this case. And, you know, there's any way, or, you know, family member of Patricia or Jesse's happens to see this, I'd love for you guys to reach out to the Higher Hope Foundation. If there's a way that we can help possibly pay for some DNA testing down the road, or, you know, in other ways, we're always here to help. But we're going to go and wrap up today's episode there. Again, hope you have a fantastic Valentine's Day, and we'll see you guys next week. Till then, lights out, everybody.